Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Brian Concannon of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, who talks about the scope of the earthquake's destruction in Haiti, delays in the distribution of aid, and the task of rebuilding the nation after the crisis. Richard Dieter of the Death Penalty Information Center, who assesses the significance of the American Law Institute's withdrawal of support for its own capital punishment guidelines and what this could mean for efforts to abolish the death penalty in the U.S. And Brian Miller with United for a Fair Economy, who discusses his group's recent report on racial disparity in the current economic crisis titled State of the Dream 2010 Drained. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On January 12th, Iranian nuclear physicist Massoud Ali Mohammadi was killed when a bomb-rigged motorcycle blew up outside his home in Tehran. Ali Mohammadi, a popular lecturer at Tehran University, supported Iran's opposition candidate Mir Hossein Mousavi. The nuclear scientist, whose writings focused on abstract theory, was not a leading dissident. Iranian authorities blamed the attack on the CIA and Israel, declaring that Ali Mohammadi was targeted for his nuclear work, although he was not known to be contributing to Iran's nuclear program. According to the Associated Press, another nuclear scientist, Shahram Amiri, disappeared in June while on a pilgrimage to Saudi Arabia. There is concern among Iranian officials that the scientist may have defected to the West and disclosed vital information about Iran's nuclear program. Iran's security services have increased repression against the pro-democracy movement, which has staged a number of major protests in the last 2 months. A December 27th confrontation with police and pro-government militias left 8 protesters dead. Afterwards, an opposition website claimed 200 people were arrested, including journalists, advisors to opposition leader Mir Hossein Mousavi, and followers of the Baha'i faith. Meanwhile, a panel in Iran's parliament has blamed former Tehran prosecutor Saeed Mordazavi, a close ally of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, for the death of 3 protesters in a detention center after the disputed election last June. 3 Irish women have gone to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, France, to overturn the Irish ban on abortion. Irish women must now travel to England and Wales to seek an abortion. The 3 women want the European Court to force Ireland to liberalize its laws on reproductive rights, which are now among the most restrictive in Europe. The current law allows an abortion only when the life of the mother is in danger. Irish voters approved the ban on abortion in 1983. According to the American Prospect magazine, the Irish case has the potential to become a European Roe v. Wade and broaden the role of international courts in expanding reproductive rights. Similar cases by international courts have expanded abortion rights. In 2005, for example, the United Nations Human Rights Committee ruled in favor of a 17-year-old Peruvian girl who was forced to give birth to a fetus which was missing much of its forebrain and could not survive outside the mother's womb. Yet there is a fear of a backlash if the European Court of Human Rights rules to overturn the Irish ban on abortion. The drive for European integration could be blunted by social conservatives. In particular, in Ireland and Poland, there's concern about more liberal attitudes on abortion and gay rights, and some do not want to be forced to adopt more progressive social policies. A year ago, President Barack Hussein Obama was sworn in as America's first black president. Today, African Americans remain Obama's most loyal supporters, but skepticism about Obama's agenda is growing. Obama came into office facing the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, a drive to reform health care, and the worst recession in 60 years. Some African Americans are now wondering where they fit in his agenda. According to the Christian Science Monitor, black unemployment rests at 16%, nearly double the jobless rate for whites. In December, 10 members of the Congressional Black Caucus boycotted a key vote on the financial reform bill, expressing unhappiness with congressional priorities. The Democratic leadership responded by increasing funding for unemployed homeowners and for neighborhood revitalization. To soothe concerns, Obama went on the American Urban Radio Network, which has a predominantly black audience, to say his stimulus bill had created jobs and saved thousands of public sector jobs for teachers and firefighters. Obama also noted African Americans had been extremely hard hit by the recession and the housing crisis. Overall, African Americans continued to give Obama strong job approval ratings, but even among blacks, the mood is beginning to sour on the Obama agenda. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
A week after the catastrophic earthquake that struck Haiti, the enormous loss of life and destruction of the already desperately poor nation was difficult to comprehend. The European Commission, citing Haitian government figures, estimated that the death toll in Haiti could reach 200,000, with another 1.5 million people left homeless. As disaster relief poured into Haiti's small airport from across the world, rescue workers from Los Angeles and Turkey worked side by side to dig through the rubble of destroyed buildings, hoping to locate survivors before they perished of injuries or lack of water. Blocked roads, inadequate infrastructure, and concerns over security delayed the transport of food, water, and emergency medical care to the hundreds of thousands of destitute citizens of Haiti's capital city and surrounding towns. President Obama has committed $100 million in aid and 10,000 U.S. troops to aid Haiti, while the U.N. approved sending 3,500 soldiers and police to bolster its force of over 9,000 already in the country. Reports of violence and looting in Haiti's earthquake-ravaged streets appear to have been exaggerated by media outlets that have provided 24-hour coverage of the disaster. Medical aid groups have complained that priority given to U.S. military aircraft landing at the Port-au-Prince airport has resulted in a 48-hour delay in the arrival of urgently needed doctors and supplies. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Brian Concannon, director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, who talks about the scope of the catastrophe, delays in the distribution of aid, and the huge task of rebuilding the nation after the crisis.
There's a close correlation between mortality and poverty. Most of the images, at least that I've seen, tend to be of the large buildings downtown, the National Palace. Dramatic shots, but where not that many people died. In fact, I'm not sure anybody died in the National Palace. And a lot of those big buildings, and some of them did have, you know, like the UN building, which is getting a lot of press. I mean, that was tragic, but in terms of numbers, I think that was maybe 100 people who died, which is horrible for those 100 people's friends and families. But there are other places, whole neighborhoods where it collapsed, where the press isn't getting to. And in those neighborhoods, people died by the thousands and the tens of thousands. And those neighborhoods are up on the hillsides over Port-au-Prince. Port-au-Prince is on a slight slope that goes right down to the ocean, but where the slope gets steeper and heads up the mountains, that's where a lot of poor people have been forced to live, and they knew it was precarious housing, but they had no other place to shelter their families, and so they moved up there. And when the final body counts come in, I think that's where the vast majority of the deceased people will have come from.
What are some of your concerns about the United Nations troops that have been there for years now and additional U.S. troops that are now pouring into Haiti? Is there any potential to increase the violence there in terms of so much desperation and men with guns pouring into Port-au-Prince?
I don't think it's the fact of that men with guns are pouring into Port-au-Prince that's a problem. I think it's the fact that they're taking up runway space for food and water pouring into Port-au-Prince. And also that what's happening, because there's been several aid flights have been canceled, or people have not been able to land with desperately needed food and water and medical supplies because the airport's choked with the arrival. And I think it's over 10,000 U.S. troops there and more are on their way, and that's addition to 9,000 UN troops and police officers. So this is a fairly large operation that's responding to a non-existent security problem. And I think that's going to create frustrations among people who've seen too much death and destruction from the earthquake, and then to see more death from the perceived need to have more soldiers there. That's fairly difficult to take, and I think it's very problematic for the relief effort and for Haiti, and I fear things could get a little bit out of control.
President Obama acted quickly here to address the Haitian problem. How would you judge the United States' response? And I know one thing that was done right off the bat was to extend Haitians living in the United States temporary protected status. What additional steps do you think the U.S. Should be taking here in view of this catastrophe?
Well, I think they should very quickly demilitarize the aid and say, look, our priority, and it's explicit that the priority is security. The priority is not aid. And I think that the best way of guaranteeing security is to get food and water and medical supplies into Haiti. And so I would say they need to immediately decelerate the arrival of troops and accelerate the arrival of emergency supplies. That's one thing. I think that and this is related. I mean, $100 million it would be a lot if it was in my bank account, but it's not an awful lot split up among 3.5 million people who have lost their home, have serious medical injuries, and can't eat and can't drink. I mean, it turns out to be it's closer to about $30 a person, which isn't going to do it. And the Obama administration has said it's evaluating what else it needs, and with the assumption that there's going to be a lot more money coming, and certainly more money needs to come. But the other issue is, coming back to the troops on the ground, 10,000 soldiers are going to start eating into $100 million fairly quickly. It's expensive to have troops on the ground. They need a lot of logistical support, and that's why they shouldn't be deployed unless it's absolutely necessary. If it was a war situation, there might not be another way of dealing with the problem, but it's much more cheaper to send doctors and people to hand out water than it is to send armed convoys. And so I think the Obama administration needs to send more aid and have it be used more effectively. But I also think we need to look at the long term, because you can't stop an earthquake and you can't stop hurricanes, but Haiti is extremely vulnerable and disproportionately vulnerable to these natural stresses. There was one example pointed out that in San Francisco's last earthquake, it was the same size as Haiti's, 7.0 in the Richter scale, in an equally populated area, and I think 70 people died. In this case, we're going to have, it looks like, at least 100,000, probably more than that. And that additional mortality, is probably explained somewhat by geologic or seismic factors, but a big part of it is the fact that you had so many of these people living in vulnerable housing on the hillsides, and so it's a man-made factor that is responsible for the extent of the damage that the natural disaster caused. And I think that what we need to do as a country is we need to support Haiti's government to provide basic services for its people, so people aren't living in unsafe areas, and people have a basic health care system, they have education, and we need to really empower the Haitian government to do that.
That was Brian Concannon, director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Visit their website at haitijustice.org. Information on how to support the Haitian people during this crisis can be found on the website of the group Partners in Health at standwithhaiti.org. In early January, the legal institute responsible for creating a framework for the death penalty and believing more than 30 years ago that it would create a fair application of capital punishment statutes withdrew its support while not coming out forcefully for repeal. In 1972, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the death penalty was carried out arbitrarily by states and was cruel and unusual punishment and therefore unconstitutional. At that point, the American Law Institute, made up of the nation's most respected lawyers, judges, and legal scholars, developed guidelines to help determine which individuals convicted of murder should face the death penalty. They included consideration of aggravating circumstances such as multiple victims, death of a police officer, and the victim's age. They also considered mitigating circumstances such as the conditions under which the perpetrator was raised, abuse he or she may have suffered, and mental incompetence. The Supreme Court relied heavily on these guidelines in determining whether states could reinstitute their death penalties beginning in 1976. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Richard Dieter, executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center, about the Law Institute's withdrawal of support for its own capital punishment guidelines and what this could mean for efforts to abolish the death penalty in the United States.
They try to present the legal system with things like the model penal code, ways of arriving at just sentences and criminal procedures that are fair, and they dealt with the death penalty by at a time when the death penalty had no guidelines and was totally up to the jury, just didn't have any list of things that they had to settle for. They put out this code of how to deal with capital sentencing, and the Supreme Court, in approving the death penalty in 1976, took a state that followed it very closely, and other states have followed suit. So the whole infrastructure, if you will, of the modern death penalty is based on this model penal code. They said, the American Law Institute, what we offered was our best advice, and it hasn't worked. We don't have any other way to make this system be trustworthy and fair. And so we're not only withdrawing the model penal code, we're withdrawing from giving any advice. We don't think there can be a systematic way of deciding who should live and who should die that works out fairly.
So these guidelines weren't mandated by the Supreme Court, but they were pretty much what the Supreme Court said was needed in order for states to reinstitute the death penalty. And some of these guidelines included mitigating and aggravating circumstances, right?
Yeah, so instead of just jury go decide whether this man should live or die, they said, you know, consider this list of mitigating things. Here are some things that ought to be age, mental problems, and consider, more importantly, the aggravating factors. What makes a murder death eligible? What makes it the worst of the worst? States are free to pick their own lists, if you will, but they gave a model list of things that might be, you know, particularly heinous, a torturous murder or multiple victims. And so some states might pick, the young age of the victim, but the whole idea of having a list of aggravating factors came from the American Law Institute. And then, you know, how you weigh those against the mitigating factors and whether the jury needs to be unanimous and all sorts of things were in that model penal code. The significant thing was that you pretty much had to have that kind of list to get the Supreme Court to approve your law.
So the American Law Institute is saying that the death penalty is still arbitrary?
Right. That you know, if you look around who gets the death penalty, you know, there's been now a lot of studies. It's much more likely that you'll get the death penalty, for example, if you've murdered a white person than if you've murdered a black person. Obviously, that's not in their list. It clearly makes a difference whether you're in Texas versus Kansas or most other states. Arbitrary factors have continued to plague the death penalty. Humans will fall back on their emotions and their biases and their arbitrary reasons, and politics will enter, and that's the death penalty experience of the past 30 years. So they just opted out of the whole process.
How important is this development to the debate about capital punishment?
This is very important from a legal perspective, in the sense that the Supreme Court, had struck down the death penalty for all federal states, and the process by which they slowly allowed it to come back was an experiment. It wasn't a clear practice that they knew now had been tested and would work. They said, well, we're going to approve this prospectively. And so we've had a 30-year experiment, not just in the eyes of the American Law Institute, but in the eyes of the court. And I think there probably is a growing consensus on the court. I don't know if it's a majority, but a growing number, Justice Stevens being a prime example, where they've just concluded this thing isn't working. And I think there will be a day when the U.S. Supreme Court strikes down the death penalty, and this will be cited as one of the reasons.
That was Richard Dieter of the Death Penalty Information Center. Contact the center at area code 202-289-2275 or visit their website at deathpenaltyinfo.org. In a report assessing the state of economic disparity in America, released to coincide with the U.S. holiday celebrating the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., the group United for a Fair Economy found that targeted assistance is required to address the nation's racial divide during the current economic crisis. Despite the historic election of the first African-American president, inequality in employment, education, health care, and wealth continue to persist. The U.S. December unemployment report determined that unemployment for African-Americans and Latinos jumped to the highest annual rate seen in 27 years. United for a Fair Economy's seventh annual report titled State of the Dream 2010, Drained, Jobless and Foreclosed in Communities of Color, concluded that the nation's economic recovery policies are not reaching those who need help the most. Although hundreds of billions of dollars in stimulus funds were distributed through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the group determined that most job creation projects did not go to the communities hardest hit by unemployment and poverty. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Brian Miller, executive director of United for a Fair Economy and one of the five co-authors of the report. He discusses the conclusions of the State of the Dream report and recommendations made to allocate assistance to communities plagued by high unemployment and foreclosures, which he believes can assist in generating a ground-up recovery for the entire nation.
If you look at unemployment over the last year, basically since the recession kicked in, what you've seen is a widening of the gap between communities of color and whites. Basically, about a year ago, December 2008, the gap between white and black unemployment was 5.5%. That gap is now over 7%. The unemployment rate among whites is 9%. Among African Americans, it's 16.2%. So you're talking about a 7.2% gap in unemployment now, and it's gotten wider. And the same thing with Latinos. Latinos are now employed at just under 13%. And so what we've seen is that a disproportionate share of the layoffs and the economic consequences of this recession are hitting communities of color. The gap is getting wider. And that's not unlike what we've already seen with the foreclosure crisis, where a disproportionate share of foreclosures are also hitting communities of color. In that case, it's a different dynamic. That was being driven largely by predatory lending of financial institutions. And so, in putting this report together, we looked at all these disparities, but we also really looked at policy solutions and what can work, both from a wise use of our limited economic development dollars, but also from a standpoint of helping close some of these vast disparities. And so what we've really done is put forth some solid recommendations, including the targeting of job creation projects into communities with the highest unemployment rates. Right now, a lot of what you coming out of Washington is sort of broad spectrum job creation initiatives about revitalizing infrastructure and green investments. And while these are all worthy investments, they're not reaching the communities that are being hit hardest by the recession. What we're calling for is targeted job creation that really goes after communities with the highest unemployment rates in the country.
Brian, the fact that we now have America's first African-American president and a lot of sensitivity about race-specific legislation. Is there a hesitancy that you detect on the part of the White House and Congress to target communities of color that are being hit hardest by unemployment in this horrible recession, given that there's a political price to pay, possibly, in the minds of some of these congressmen and senators for doing so?
Even if we didn't have an African-American president, that would be problematic. And there's a lot of political pushback when you target job creation dollars specifically to communities of color. And I think that's why the Congressional Black Caucus knows this, which is why what they were putting forward and what they're continuing to push is targeting job creation dollars to communities with the highest unemployment rates, regardless of race. And that's targeting that is politically acceptable. It's also targeting that makes sense. You know, right now what we saw with the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and again, there's some really good public investments in there that we wholeheartedly support. But the reality is the jobs that are being created through that are, I believe right now, there was a study done last year that showed that communities with the lowest rate of unemployment actually got 50% more per capita in job creation dollars than communities with the highest unemployment rates. And part of that is because they focused on projects that were shovel-ready, and of course a lot of these lower-income communities didn't have shovel-ready projects because, well, they didn't think the money would be coming down anytime soon, or for whatever reason, the shovel-ready projects that got pushed up to the top were in communities that weren't doing as badly. And so what we need to do is we need to continue doing some element of that broad-spectrum job creation, but supplement it with a significant chunk of revenue that is dedicated to communities with the highest rates of unemployment, people and places with the highest rates of unemployment.
Maybe you could just summarize for us some of the concerns you have looking at the country in 2010 and the racial divide that still exists generally, and what work we need to do as a nation despite the election of Barack Obama.
And, you know, obviously the election of Barack Obama is a huge historic watershed for a nation, but people are still facing some of the same challenges they've faced for the last, you know, several decades, whatever, or longer. As we mentioned, that you know, the unemployment disparities are vast. It's African Americans are almost twice as likely to be unemployed as whites, and Latinos, I think, are 1.5 times or 1.6 times, 1.5 times as likely to be unemployed. So these disparities are vast, and they're huge on the unemployment. Even once you get people who are employed, though, people of color tend to be employed in the lower-rung positions and not in the higher executive positions that pay the bigger dollars. So you have serious stratification even once you achieve those who are employed. That's income disparities. When you look at wealth disparities, the gap is so much more vast. It's hard to imagine the disparities of wealth that exist in this country across the lines of race. First off, the disparities of wealth that exist, period, regardless of race, are at the highest levels they've been since the 1920s, just before the Great Depression. You know, when you superimpose race on that, you get some tremendous disparities. Right now, African Americans have a dime, 10 cents. Of net wealth for every dollar of white net wealth, and Latinos have only 12 cents. Part of the reason the wealth disparities are so much more vast than the income disparities is because wealth transfers from generation to generation. So even if we completely ended racism today, even if African Americans, Latinos, and whites all were unemployed or are employed, hopefully, at the same rate and got the same pay for the same jobs, these wealth disparities would continue to exist for generations to come. And what you're really looking at is all the inequities and injustices of the past carried forward with interest.
That was Brian Miller, Executive Director of United for a Fair Economy, and one of five co-authors of the report, State of the Dream 2010, Drained, Jobless, and Foreclosed in Communities of Color. Obtain a copy of the report by visiting the group's website at faireconomy.org or call them at area code 617-423-2148. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced in association with WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.